Chapter 1. A Fair Vestal, Throned in the West. Elfride Swancourt was a girl whose emotions lay very near the surface. Their nature more precisely, and as modified by the creeping hours of time, was known only to those who watched the circumstances of her history. Personally, she was the combination of very interesting particulars, whose rarity, however, lay in the combination itself rather than in the individual elements combined. As a matter of fact, you did not see the form and substance of her features when conversing with her, and this charming power of preventing a material study of her lineaments by an interlocutor, originated not in the cloaking effect of a well-formed manner, for her manner was childish and scarcely formed, but in the attractive crudeness of the remarks themselves. She had lived all her life in retirement. The monstrari gigito of idle men had not flattered her, and at the age of 19 or 20 she was no further on in social consciousness than an urban young lady of 15. One point in her, however, you did notice, that was her eyes. In them was seen a sublimation of all of her, it was not necessary to look further, there she lived. These eyes were blue, blue as autumn distance, blue as the blue we see between the retreating moldings of hills and woody slopes on a sunny September morning. A misty and shady blue, that had no beginning or surface, and was looked into rather than at. As to her presence, it was not powerful, it was weak. Some women can make their personality pervade the atmosphere of the whole banqueting hall. Elfride's was no more pervasive than that of a kitten. Elfride had as her own the thoughtfulness which appears in the face of the Madonna della Sedia, without its rapture, the warmth and spirit of the type of woman's feature most common to the beauties mortal and immortal of Rubens, without their insistent flashiness. The characteristic expression of the female faces of Correggio, that of the yearning human thoughts that lie too deep for tears, was hers sometimes, but seldom under ordinary conditions. The point in Elfride Swancourt's life at which a deeper current may be said to have permanently set in, was one winter afternoon when she found herself standing, in the character of hostess, face to face with a man she had never seen before, moreover, looking at him with a Miranda-like curiosity and interest that she had never yet bestowed on a mortal. On this particular day her father, the vicar of a parish on the sea-swept outskirts of Lower Wessex, and a widower, was suffering from an attack of gout. After finishing her household supervision, Elfride became restless, and several times left the room, ascended the staircase, and knocked at her father's chamber door. "Come in," was always answered in a hearty out-of-door voice from the inside. "Papa," she said on one occasion to the fine, red-faced, handsome man of 40, who, puffing and fizzing like a bursting bottle, lay on the bed wrapped in a dressing gown, and every now and then enunciating, in spite of himself, about one letter of some word or words that were almost oaths, "Papa, will you not come downstairs this evening?" She spoke distinctly, he was rather deaf. "Afraid not, ahh. Very much afraid I shall not, Elfride. Piff ph ph. I can't bear even a handkerchief upon this deuce toe of mine, much less a stocking or slipper. Piff ph ph. There 'tis again. No, I shan't get up till tomorrow. Then I hope this London man won't come, for I don't know what I should do, Papa." "Well, it would be awkward, certainly. I should hardly think he would come today."
"Why?"
"Because the wind blows so."
"Wind?
What ideas you have, Elfride. Whoever heard of wind stopping a man from doing his business? The idea of this toe of mine coming on so suddenly, exclamation mark dot dot dot. If he should come, you must send him up to me, I suppose, and then give him some food and put him to bed in some way. Dear me, what a nuisance all this is. Must he have dinner? Too heavy for a tired man at the end of a tedious journey.
Tea, then?
Not substantial enough.
High tea, then?
There is cold fowl, rabbit pie, some pasties, and things of that kind.
Yes, high tea.
Must I pour out his tea, Papa?
Of course, you are the mistress of the house.
What? Sit there all the time with a stranger, just as if I knew him, and not anybody to introduce us?
Nonsense, child, about introducing, you know better than that. A practical professional man, tired and hungry, who has been traveling ever since daylight this morning, will hardly be inclined to talk and air courtesies tonight. He wants food and shelter, and you must see that he has it, simply because I am suddenly laid up and cannot. There is nothing so dreadful in that, I hope? You get all kinds of stuff into your head from reading so many of those novels.
Oh no, there is nothing dreadful in it when it becomes plainly a case of necessity like this. But, you see, you are always there when people come to dinner, even if we know them, and this is some strange London man of the world, who will think it odd, perhaps.
Very well, let him. Is he Mr. Hubie's partner? I should scarcely think so, he may be. How old is he, I wonder? That I cannot tell. You will find the copy of my letter to Mr. Hubie, and his answer, upon the table in the study. You may read them, and then you'll know as much as I do about our visitor. I have read them. Well, what's the use of asking questions, then? They contain all I know. Okay. Plague you, you young scamp. Don't put anything there. I can't bear the weight of a fly. Oh, I am sorry, Papa. I forgot, I thought you might be cold, she said, hastily removing the rug she had thrown upon the feet of the sufferer, and waiting till she saw that consciousness of her offense had passed from his face, she withdrew from the room, and retired again downstairs. Chapter 2. 'Twas on the evening of a winter's day. When two or three additional hours had merged the same afternoon and evening, some moving outlines might have been observed against the sky on the summit of a wild lone hill in that district. They circumscribed two men, having it present the aspect of silhouettes, sitting in a dogcart and pushing along in the teeth of the wind. Scarcely a solitary house or man had been visible along the whole dreary distance of open country they were traversing, and now that night had begun to fall, the faint twilight, which still gave an idea of the landscape to their observation, was enlivened by the quiet appearance of the planet Jupiter, momentarily gleaming in intenser brilliancy in front of them, and by Sirius shedding his rays in rivalry from his position over their shoulders. The only lights apparent on Earth were some spots of dull red, glowing here and there upon the distant hills, which, as the driver of the vehicle gratuitously remarked to the hirer, were smoldering fires for the consumption of peat and gorse roots, where the common was being broken up for agricultural purposes. The wind prevailed with but little abatement from its daytime boisterousness, three or four small clouds, delicate and pale, creeping along under the sky southward to the channel. 14 of the 16 miles intervening between the railway terminus and the end of their journey had been gone over, when they began to pass along the brink of a valley some miles in extent, wherein the wintry skeletons of a more luxuriant vegetation than had hitherto surrounded them proclaimed an increased richness of soil, which showed signs of far more careful enclosure and management than had any slopes they had yet passed. A little farther, and an opening in the elms stretching up from this fertile valley revealed the mansion. That's Endelstow House, Lord Loxley's, said the driver. Endelstow House, Lord Loxley's, repeated the other mechanically. He then turned himself sideways, and keenly scrutinized the almost invisible house with an interest which the indistinct picture itself seemed far from adequate to create. Yes, that's Lord Loxley's, he said yet again after a while, as he still looked in the same direction. What, be we going there? No, Endelstow Vicarage, as I have told you. I thought you mt have altered your mind, sir, as ye have stared that way at nothing so long. Oh no, I am interested in the house, that's all. Most people be, as the saying is. Not in the sense that I am. Oh! Well, his family is no better than my own, I believe. How is that? Hedgers and ditchers by rights. But once in ancient times one of them, when he was at work, changed clothes with King Charles II, and saved the king's life. King Charles came up to him like a common man, and said offhand, man in the smock frock, my name is Charles II, and that's the truth on't. Will you lend me your clothes? I don't mind if I do, said Hedger Luxellian, and they changed there and then. Now mind ye, King Charles II said, like a common man, as he rode away, if ever I come to the crown, you come to court, knock at the door, and say out bold, is King Charles II at home? Tell your name, and they shall let you in, and you shall be made a lord. Now, that was very nice of Master Charlie? Very nice indeed. Well, as the story is, the king came to the throne, and some years after that, away went Hedger Luxellian, knocked at the king's door, and asked if King Charles II was in. No, he isn't, they said. Then, is Charles III? Said Hedger Luxellian. Yes, said a young feller standing by like a common man, only he had a crown on, my name is Charles III. And I really fancy that must be a mistake. I don't recollect anything in English history about Charles III, said the other in a tone of mild remonstrance. Oh, that's right history enough, only 'twasn't printed, he was rather a queer-tempered man, if you remember. Very well, go on. And, by hook or by crook, Hedger Luxellian was made a lord, and everything went on well till some time after, when he got into a most terrible row with King Charles IV. I can't stand Charles IV. Upon my word, that's too much.
Why? There was a George IV, wasn't there?
Certainly. Well, Charles's be as common as George's. However, I'll say no more about it.
Ah, well.
'Tis the funniest world ever I lived in upon my life, 'tis.
Ah, that such should be.
The dusk had thickened into darkness while they thus conversed, and the outline and surface of the mansion gradually disappeared. The windows, which had before been as black blots on a lighter expanse of wall, became illuminated, and were transfigured to squares of light on the general dark body of the night landscape as it absorbed the outlines of the edifice into its gloomy monochrome. Not another word was spoken for some time, and they climbed a hill, then another hill piled on the summit of the first. An additional mile of plateau followed, from which could be discerned two lighthouses on the coast they were nearing, reposing on the horizon with the calm luster of benignity. Another oasis was reached, a little dell lay like a nest at their feet, towards which the driver pulled the horse at a sharp angle, and descended a steep slope which dived under the trees like a rabbit's burrow. They sank lower and lower. Endelstow Vicarage is inside here, continued the man with the reins. This part about here is West Endelstow, Lord Luxellian's is East Endelstow, and has a church to itself. Passon Swancourt is the passon of both, and bobs backward and forward.
Ah, well. 'Tis a funny world. I believe there was once a quarry where this house stands.
The man who built it in past time scraped all the glebe for earth to put round the vicarage, and laid out a little paradise of flowers and trees in the soil he had got together in this way, whilst the fields he scraped have been good for nothing ever since.
How long has the present incumbent been here?
Maybe about a year, or a year and a half, 'tis in 2 years, for they don't scandalize him yet, and, as a rule, a parish begins to scandalize the passon at the end of 2 years among 'em familiar. But he's a very nice party.
Passon Swancourt knows me pretty well from often driving over, and I know Passon Swancourt.
They emerged from the bower, swept round in a curve, and the chimneys and gables of the vicarage became darkly visible. Not a light showed anywhere. They alighted, the man felt his way into the porch, and rang the bell. At the end of 3 or 4 minutes, spent in patient waiting without hearing any sounds of a response, the stranger advanced and repeated the call in a more decided manner. He then fancied he heard footsteps in the hall, and sundry movements of the doorknob, but nobody appeared.
Perhaps they bean't at home, sighed the driver.
And I promised myself a bit of supper in Passon Swancourt's kitchen. Zish lovely meat pies and fig cakes, and cider, and drops of cordial that they do keep here.
All right, neighbors. Be ye rich men or be ye poor men, that ye must needs come to the world's end at this time of night? Exclaimed a voice at this instant, and, turning their heads, they saw a rickety individual shambling round from the back door with a horn lantern dangling from his hand.
Time o' night, I believe. And the clock only gone 7 of 'em.
Show a light, and let us in, William Worm.
Oh, that you, Robert Lickpin?
Nobody else, William Worm.
And is the visiting man a come?
Yes, said the stranger.
Is Mr. Swancourt at home?
That is, sir.
And would ye mind coming round by the back way? The front door is got stuck by the wet, as he will do sometimes, and the Turk can't open in. I know I am only a poor wambling man that I'll never pay the Lord for my making, sir, but I can show the way in, sir.
The new arrival followed his guide through a little door in a wall, and then promenaded a scullery in a kitchen, along which he passed with eyes rigidly fixed in advance, an inbred horror of prying forbidding him to gaze around apartments that formed the backside of the household tapestry. Entering the hall, he was about to be shown to his room, when from the inner lobby of the front entrance, whither she had gone to learn the cause of the delay, sailed forth the form of Elfride. Her start of amazement at the sight of the visitor coming forth from under the stairs proved that she had not been expecting this surprising flank movement, which had been originated entirely by the ingenuity of William Worm. She appeared in the prettiest of all feminine guises, that is to say, in the neat toilette, with plenty of loose curly hair tumbling down about her shoulders. An expression of uneasiness pervaded her countenance, and altogether she scarcely appeared woman enough for the situation. The visitor removed his hat, and the first words were spoken, Elfride prelusively looking with a deal of interest, not unmixed with surprise, at the person towards whom she was to do the duties of hospitality.
I am Mr. Smith, said the stranger in a musical voice.
I am Miss Swancourt, said Elfride.
Her constraint was over. The great contrast between the reality she beheld before her, and the dark, taciturn, sharp, elderly man of business who had lurked in her imagination, a man with clothes smelling of city smoke, skin sallow from want of sun, and talk flavored with epigram was such a relief to her that Elfried smiled, almost laughed, in the newcomer's face. Stephen Smith, who has hitherto been hidden from us by the darkness, was at this time of his life but a youth in appearance, and barely a man in years. Judging from his look, London was the last place in the world that one would have imagined to be the scene of his activities. Such a face surely could not be nourished amid smoke and mud and fog and dust. Such an open countenance could never even have seen anything of the weariness, the fever, and the fret of Babylon II. His complexion was as fine as Alfred's own, the pink of his cheeks as delicate. His mouth as perfect as Cupid's bow in form, and as cherry red in color as hers. Bright curly hair, bright sparkling blue-gray eyes, a boy's blush and manner, neither whisker nor mustache, unless a little light brown fur on his upper lip deserved the latter title, this composed the London professional man, the prospect of whose advent had so troubled Elfried. Elfried hastened to say she was sorry to tell him that Mr. Swancourt was not able to receive him that evening, and gave the reason why. Mr. Smith replied, in a voice boyish by nature and manly by art, that he was very sorry to hear this news, but that as far as his reception was concerned, it did not matter in the least. Stephen was shown up to his room. In his absence Elfried stealthily glided into her father's. "He's come, Papa. Such a young man for a businessman."
"Oh, indeed.
His face is well pretty, just like mine."
"H.M. What next?"
"Nothing, that's all I know of him yet. It is rather nice, is it not?"
"Well, we shall see that when we know him better. Go down and give the poor fellow something to eat and drink, for heaven's sake. And when he has done eating, say I should like to have a few words with him, if he doesn't mind coming up here."
The young lady glided downstairs again, and whilst she awaits young Smith's entry, the letters referring to his visit had better be given. 1. Mr. Swancourt to Mr. Hubie. Endelstow Vicarage, February 18, 18. "Sir, we are thinking of restoring the tower and aisle of the church in this parish, and Lord Luxellian, the patron of the living, has mentioned your name as that of a trustworthy architect whom it would be desirable to ask to superintend the work. I am exceedingly ignorant of the necessary preliminary steps. Probably, however, the first is that, should you be, as Lord Luxellian says you are, disposed to assist us, yourself or some member of your staff come and see the building, and report thereupon for the satisfaction of parishioners and others. The spot is a very remote one, we have no railway within 14 miles, and the nearest place for putting up it called a town, though merely a large village, is Castle Botterell, 2 miles further on, so that it would be most convenient for you to stay at the vicarage, which I am glad to place at your disposal instead of pushing on to the hotel at Castle Botterell, and coming back again in the morning. Any day of the next week that you like to name for the visit will find us quite ready to receive you. Yours very truly, Christopher Swancourt."
2.
Mr. Hubie to Mr. Swancourt. "Percy Place, Charing Cross, February 20, 18. "Dear Sir, agreeably to your request of the 18th instant, I have arranged to survey and make drawings of the island tower of your parish church, and of the dilapidations which have been suffered to accrue thereto, with a view to its restoration. My assistant, Mr. Stephen Smith, will leave London by the early train tomorrow morning for the purpose. Many thanks for your proposal to accommodate him. He will take advantage of your offer, and will probably reach your house at some hour of the evening. You may put every confidence in him, and may rely upon his discernment in the matter of church architecture. Trusting that the plans for the restoration, which I shall prepare from the details of his survey, will prove satisfactory to yourself and Lord Luxellian, I am, dear sir, yours faithfully, Walter Hubie." Chapter 3. Melodious birds sing madrigals. That first repast in Endelstow Vicarage was a very agreeable one to young Stephen Smith. The table was spread, as Elfried had suggested to her father, with the materials for the heterogeneous meal called high tea, a class of refection welcome to all when away from men and towns, and particularly attractive to youthful palates. The table was prettily decked with winter flowers and leaves, amid which the eye was greeted by shops, chicken, pie, and sea, and two huge pasties overhanging the sides of the dish with a cheerful aspect of abundance. At the end, towards the fireplace, appeared the tea service, of old-fashioned Worcester porcelain, and behind this arose the slight form of Elfried, attempting to add matronly dignity to the movement of pouring out tea, and to have a weighty and concerned look in matters of marmalade, honey, and clotted cream.
Having made her own meal before he arrived, she found to her embarrassment that there was nothing left for her to do but talk when not assisting him. She asked him if he would excuse her finishing a letter she had been writing at a side table, and, after sitting down to it, tingled with a sense of being grossly rude. However, seeing that he noticed nothing personally wrong in her, and that he too was embarrassed when she attentively watched his cup to refill it, Alfred became better at ease, and when furthermore he accidentally kicked the leg of the table, and then nearly upset his teacup, just as schoolboys did, she felt herself mistress of the situation, and could talk very well. In a few minutes, ingenuousness and a common term of years obliterated all recollection that they were strangers just met. Stephen began to wax eloquent on extremely slight experiences connected with his professional pursuits, and she, having no experiences to fall back upon, recounted with much animation stories that had been related to her by her father, which would have astonished him had he heard with what fidelity of action and tone they were rendered. Upon the whole, a very interesting picture of Suite and 20 was on view that evening in Mr. Swancourt's house. Ultimately, Stephen had to go upstairs and talk loud to the vicar, receiving from him between his puffs a great many apologies for calling him so unceremoniously to a stranger's bedroom. "But," continued Mr. Swancourt, "I felt that I wanted to say a few words to you before the morning, on the business of your visit. One's patience gets exhausted by staying a prisoner in bed all day through a sudden freak of one's enemy new to me, though for I have known very little of gout as yet. However, he's gone to my other toe in a very mild manner, and I expect he'll slink off altogether by the morning. I hope you have been well attended to downstairs?"
"Perfectly.
And though it is unfortunate, and I am sorry to see you laid up, I beg you will not take the slightest notice of my being in the house the while."
"I will not.
But I shall be down tomorrow. My daughter is an excellent doctor. A dose or two of her mild mixtures will fetch me round quicker than all the drug stuff in the world. Well, now about the church business. Take a seat, do. We can't afford to stand upon ceremony in these parts, as you see, and for this reason, that a civilized human being seldom stays long with us, and so we cannot waste time in approaching him, or he will be gone before we have had the pleasure of close acquaintance. This hour of ours is, as you will notice, entirely gone beyond the possibility of restoration, but the church itself is well enough. You should see some of the churches in this county. Floors rotten, ivy lining the walls.
Dear me.
Oh, that's nothing. The congregation of a neighbor of mine, whenever a storm of rain comes on during service, open their umbrellas and hold them up till the dripping ceases from the roof. Now, if you will kindly bring me those papers and letters you see lying on the table, I will show you how far we have got." Stephen crossed the room to fetch them, and the vicar seemed to notice more particularly the slim figure of his visitor. "I suppose you are quite competent?" he said.
"Quite," said the young man, coloring slightly.
"You are very young. I fancy I should say you are not more than 19?
"I am nearly 21.
"Exactly half my age, I am 42. "By the way," said Mr. Swancourt, after some conversation, "you said your whole name was Stephen Fitzmaurice, and that your grandfather came originally from Caxbury. Since I have been speaking, it has occurred to me that I know something of you. You belong to a well-known ancient county family, not ordinary Smiths in the least. I don't think we have any of their blood in our veins."
"Nonsense.
You must. Hand me the landed gentry. Now, let me see. There, Stephen Fitzmaurice Smith, he lies in St. Mary's Church, doesn't he? Well, out of that family sprang the Leaseworthy Smiths, and collaterally came General Sir Stephen Fitzmaurice Smith of Caxbury."
"Yes, I have seen his monument there," shouted Stephen.
"But there is no connection between his family and mine, there cannot be."
"There is none, possibly, to your knowledge. But look at this, my dear sir," said the vicar, striking his fist upon the bedpost for emphasis. "Here are you, Stephen Fitzmaurice Smith, living in London, but springing from Caxbury. Here in this book is a genealogical tree of the Stephen Fitzmaurice Smiths of Caxbury Manor. You may be only a family of professional men now. I am not inquisitive, I don't ask questions of that kind, it is not in me to do so, but it is as plain as the nose in your face that there's your origin. And, Mr. Smith, I congratulate you upon your blood, blue blood, sir, and, upon my life, a very desirable color, as the world goes. I wish you could congratulate me upon some more tangible quality," said the younger man, sadly no less than modestly.
"Nonsense. That will come with time. You are young, all your life is before you. Now look, see how far back in the mists of antiquity my own family of Swancourt have a root. Here, You see, he continued, turning to the page, is Geoffrey, the one among my ancestors who lost a barony because he would cut his joke. It's the sort of us. But the story is too long to tell now. I'm a poor man, a poor gentleman. In fact, those I would be friends with, won't be friends with me. Those who are willing to be friends with me, I am above being friends with. Beyond dining with a neighboring incumbent or two, and an occasional chat, sometimes dinner with Lord Loxolian, a connection of mine, I am in absolute solitude, absolute. You have your studies, your books, and your daughter. Oh yes, yes, and I don't complain of poverty. Canto Coram Latrone. Well, Mr. Smith, don't let me detain you any longer in a sick room. Huh? That reminds me of a story I once heard in my younger days. Here the vicar began a series of small private laughs, and Stephen looked inquiry. Oh, no, no. It is too bad to tell. Continued Mr. Swancourt in undertones of grim mirth. Well, go downstairs, my daughter must do the best she can with you this evening. Ask her to sing to you, she plays and sings very nicely. Good night, I feel as if I had known you for 5 or 6 years. I'll ring for somebody to show you down. Never mind, said Stephen, I can find the way. And he went downstairs, thinking of the delightful freedom of manner in the remoter counties in comparison with the reserve of London. I forgot to tell you that my father was rather deaf, said Alfred anxiously, when Stephen entered the little drawing room. Never mind, I know all about it, and we are great friends, the man of business replied enthusiastically. And, Miss Swancourt, will you kindly sing to me? To Miss Swancourt this request seemed, what in fact it was, exceptionally point-blank, though she guessed that her father had some hand in framing it, knowing, rather to her cost, of his unceremonious way of utilizing her for the benefit of dull sojourners. At the same time, as Mr. Smith's manner was too frank to provoke criticism, and his age too little to inspire fear, she was ready not to say please to exceed. Selecting from the Canterbury some old family ditties, that in years gone by had been played and sung by her mother, Alfred sat down to the pianoforte, and began, "'Twas on the evening of a winter's day," in a pretty contralto voice. "'Do you like that old thing, Mr. Smith?' she said at the end. "'Yes, I do much,' said Stephen, words he would have uttered, and sincerely, to anything on earth, from Glee to Requiem, that she might have chosen. "'You shall have a little one by Delara, that was given me by a young French lady who was staying at Endelstow House. J'ai li planned, j'ai li vu naître, c'est beau rosier ou l'oiseau, and see. And then I shall want to give you my own favorite for the very last, Shelley's When the Lamp is Shattered, as set to music by my poor mother. I so much like singing to anybody who really cares to hear me. Every woman who makes a permanent impression on a man is usually recalled to his mind's eye as she appeared in one particular scene, which seems ordained to be her special form of manifestation throughout the pages of his memory. As the patron saint has her attitude and accessories in medieval illumination, so the sweetheart may be said to have hers upon the table of her true love's fancy, without which she is rarely introduced there except by effort, and this though she may, on further acquaintance, have been observed in many other faces which one would imagine to be far more appropriate to love's young dream. Miss Elfride's image chose the form in which she was beheld during these minutes of singing, for her permanent attitude of visitation to Stephen's eyes during his sleeping and waking hours in after days. The profile is seen of a young woman in a pale gray silk dress with trimmings of swan's down, and opening up from a point in front, like a waistcoat without a shirt, the cool color contrasting admirably with the warm bloom of her neck and face. The furthermost candle on the piano comes immediately in a line with her head, and half invisible itself, forms the accidentally frizzled hair into a nebulous haze of light, surrounding her crown like an aureola. Her hands are in their place on the keys, her lips parted, and trilling forth, in a tender diminuendo, the closing words of the sad apostrophe. O love, who bewailest the frailty of all things here, why choose you the frailest for your cradle, your home, and your bier? Her head is forward a little, and her eyes directed keenly upward to the top of the page of music confronting her. Then comes a rapid look into Stephen's face, and a still more rapid look back again to her business, her face having dropped its sadness, and acquired a certain expression of mischievous archness the while, which lingered there for some time, but was never developed into a positive smile of flirtation. Stephen suddenly shifted his position from her right hand to her left, where there was just room enough for a small ottoman to stand between the piano and the corner of the room. Into this nook he squeezed himself, and gazed wistfully up into Elfride's face. So long and so earnestly gazed he, that her cheek deepened to a more and more crimson tint as each line was added to her song. Concluding, and pausing motionless after the last word for a minute or two, she ventured to look at him again. His features wore an expression of unutterable heaviness. "You don't hear many songs, do you, Mr. Smith, to take so much notice of these of mine?" "Perhaps it was the means and vehicle of the song that I was noticing, I mean yourself," he answered gently. "Now, Mr. Smith, it is perfectly true, I don't hear much singing. You mistake what I am, I fancy. Because I come as a stranger to a secluded spot, you think I must needs come from a life of bustle, and know the latest movements of the day. But I don't. My life is as quiet as yours, and more solitary, solitary as death. The death which comes from a plethora of life? But seriously, I can quite see that you are not the least what I thought you would be before I saw you. You are not critical, or experienced, or much to mind. That's why I don't mind singing airs to you that I only half know." Finding that by this confession she had vexed him in a way she did not intend, she added naively, "I mean, Mr. Smith, that you are better, not worse, for being only young and not very experienced. You don't think my life here so very tame and dull, I know." "I do not, indeed," he said with fervor. "It must be delightfully poetical, and sparkling, and fresh, and..." "There you go, Mr. Smith. Well, men of another kind, when I get them to be honest enough to own the truth, think just the reverse, that my life must be a dreadful bore in its normal state, though pleasant for the exceptional few days they pass here. I could live here always," he said, and with such a tone and look of unconscious revelation that Elfride was startled to find that her harmonies had fired a small Troy, in the shape of Stephen's heart. She said quickly, "But you can't live here always." "Oh no." And he drew himself in with the sensitiveness of a snail. Elfride's emotions were sudden as his enkindling, but the least of woman's lesser infirmities, love of admiration, caused an inflammable disposition on his part, so exactly similar to her own, to appear as meritorious in him as modesty made her own seem culpable in her. Chapter 4. Where heaps the turf in many a mouldering heap. For reasons of his own, Stephen Smith was stirring a short time after dawn the next morning. From the window of his room he could see, first, two bold escarpments sloping down together like the letter V towards the bottom, like liquid in a funnel, appeared the sea, gray and small. On the brow of one hill, of rather greater altitude than its neighbor, stood the church which was to be the scene of his operations. The lonely edifice was black and bare, cutting up into the sky from the very tip of the hill. It had a square moldering tower, owning neither battlement nor pinnacle, and seemed a monolithic termination, of one substance with a ridge, rather than a structure raised thereon. Round the church ran a low wall, overtopping the wall in general level was the graveyard, not as a graveyard usually is, a fragment of landscape with its due variety of chiaro oscuro, but a mere profile against the sky, serrated with the outlines of graves in a very few memorial stones. Not a tree could exist up there, nothing but the monotonous gray-green grass. 5 minutes after this casual survey was made, his bedroom was empty, and its occupant had vanished quietly from the house. At the end of 2 hours he was again in the room, looking warm and glowing. He now pursued the artistic details of dressing, which on his first rising had been entirely omitted. And a very blooming boy he looked, after that mysterious morning's scamper. His mouth was a triumph of its class. It was the cleanly cut, piquantly pursed up mouth of William Pitt, as represented in the well or little known bust by Nollekens, a mouth which is in itself a young man's fortune, if properly exercised. His round chin, where its upper part turned inward, still continued its perfect and full curve, seeming to press into a point the bottom of his nether lip at their place of junction. Once he murmured the name of Elfride. Ah, there she was. On the lawn in a plain dress, without hat or bonnet, running with a boy's velocity, superadded to a girl's lightness, after a tame rabbit she was endeavoring to capture, her strategic intonations of coaxing words alternating with desperate rushes so much out of keeping with him, that the hollowness of such expressions was but too evident to her pet, who darted and dodged in carefully timed counterpart. The scene down there was altogether different from that of the hills. A thicket of shrubs and trees enclosed the favored spot from the wilderness without. Even at this time of the year the grass was luxuriant there. No wind blew inside the protecting belt of evergreens, wasting its force upon the higher and stronger trees forming the outer margin of the grove. Then he heard a heavy person shuffling about in slippers, and calling Mr. Smith. Smith proceeded to the study, and found Mr. Swancourt. The young man expressed his gladness to see his host downstairs. "Oh yes, I knew I should soon be right again. I have not made the acquaintance of Gat for more than 2 years, and it generally goes off the second night.
Well, where have you been this morning? I saw you come in just now, I think.
Yes, I have been for a walk.
Start early?
Yes.
Very early, I think.
Yes, it was rather early.
Which way did you go?
To the sea, I suppose. Everybody goes seaward.
No, I followed up the river as far as the park wall.
You are different from your kind.
Well, I suppose such a wild place is a novelty, and so tempted you out of bed?
Not altogether a novelty. I like it.
The youth seemed averse to explanation.
You must, to go cock-watching the morning after a journey of 14 or 16 hours. But there's no accounting for tastes, and I am glad to see that yours are no meaner.
After breakfast, but not before, I shall be good for a 10 miles walk, Master Smith.
Certainly there seemed nothing exaggerated in that assertion. Mr. Swancourt by daylight showed himself to be a man who, in common with the other two people under his roof, had really strong claims to be considered handsome, that is, in the sense in which the moon is bright, the ravines and valleys which, on a close inspection, are seen to diversify its surface being left out of the argument. His face was of a tint that never deepened upon his cheeks nor lightened upon his forehead, but remained uniform throughout, the usual neutral salmon color of a man who feeds well, not to say too well, and does not think hard, every pore being in visible working order. His tat ensemble was that of a highly improved class of farmer, dressed up in the wrong clothes, that of a firm-standing perpendicular man, whose fall would have been backwards in direction if he had ever lost his balance. The vicar's background was at present what a vicar's background should be, his study. Here the consistency ends. All along the chimney-piece were ranged bottles of horse, pig, and cow medicines, and against the wall was a high table, made up of the fragments of an old oakage gate. Upon this stood stuffed specimens of owls, divers, and gulls, and over them bunches of wheat and barley ears, labeled with the date of the year that produced them. Some cases and shelves, more or less laden with books, the prominent titles of which were Dr. Brown's Notes on the Romans, Dr. Smith's Notes on the Corinthians, and Dr. Robinson's Notes on the Galatians, Ephesians, and Philippians, just saved the character of the place, in spite of a girl's doll's house standing above them, a marine aquarium in the window, and Elfride's hat hanging on its corner.
Business, said Mr. Swancourt after breakfast. He began to find it necessary to act the part of a flywheel towards the somewhat irregular forces of his visitor. They prepared to go to the church, the vicar, on second thoughts, mounting his coal-black mare to avoid exerting his foot too much at starting. Stephen said he should want a man to assist him.
Worm!
The vicar shouted. A minute or two after a voice was heard round the corner of the building, mumbling, "Ah, I used to be strong enough, but 'tis altered now. Well, there, I'm as independent as one here and there, even if they do write squire after their names."
"What's the matter?"
said the vicar, as William Worm appeared, when the remarks were repeated to him.
"Worm says some very true things sometimes," Mr. Swancourt said, turning to Stephen.
"Now, as regards that word esquire. Why, Mr. Smith, that word esquire is gone to the dogs, used on the letters of every jackanapes who has a black coat.
Anything else, Worm?"
"Eh, the folk have begun frying again."
"Dear me.
I'm sorry to hear that."
"Yes," Worm said groaningly to Stephen, "I've got such a noise in my head that there's no living night nor day. 'Tis just for all the world like people frying fish, fry, 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 all day long in my poor head, till I don't know where I'm here or yonder.
There, God Almighty will find it out sooner or later, I hope, and relieve me."
"Now, my deafness," said Mr. Swancourt impressively, "is a dead silence, but William Worm's is that of people frying fish in his head. Very remarkable, isn't it?"
"I can hear the frying pan a fizzing as natural as life," said Worm corroboratively.
"Yes, it is remarkable," said Mr. Smith.
Very peculiar," echoed the vicar, and they all then followed the path up the hill, bounded on each side by a little stone wall, from which gleamed fragments of quartz and blood-red marbles, apparently of inestimable value, in their setting of brown alluvium. Stephen walked with the dignity of a man close to the horse's head, Worm stumbled along a stone's throw in the rear, and Elfride was nowhere in particular, yet everywhere, sometimes in front, sometimes behind, sometimes at the sides, hovering about the procession like a butterfly, not definitely engaged in traveling, yet somehow chiming in at points with the general progress.
The vicar explained things as he went on. "The fact is, Mr. Smith, I didn't want this bother of church restoration at all, but it was necessary to do something in self-defense, on account of those dissenters, I use the word in its scriptural meaning, of course, not as an expletive."
"How very odd," said Stephen, with the concern demanded of serious friendliness.
"Odd? That's nothing to how it is in the parish of Twinkley. Both the church wardens are, there, I won't say what they are, and the clerk and the sexton as well?"
"How very strange," said Stephen.
"Strange? My dear sir, that's nothing to how it is in the parish of Sinnerton. However, as to our own parish, I hope we shall make some progress soon.
You must trust to circumstances."
"There are no circumstances to trust to. We may as well trust in Providence if we trust at all. But here we are. A wild place, isn't it? But I like it on such days as these." The churchyard was entered on this side by a stone stile, over which, having clambered, you remained still on the wild hill, the within not being so divided from the without as to obliterate the sense of open freedom. A delightful place to be buried in, postulating that delight can accompany a man to his tomb under any circumstances. There was nothing horrible in this churchyard, in the shape of tight mounds bonded with sticks, which shout imprisonment in the ears rather than whisper rest, or trim garden flowers, which only raise images of people in new black crepe and white handkerchiefs coming to tend them, or wheel marks, which remind us of hearses and mourning coaches, or cypress bushes, which make a parade of sorrow, or coffin boards and bones lying behind trees, showing that we are only leaseholders of our graves. No, nothing but long, wild, untutored grass, diversifying the forms of the mounds it covered, themselves irregularly shaped, with no eye to effect, the impressive presence of the old mountain, that all this was a part of being nowhere excluded by disguising art. Outside were similar slopes and similar grass, and then the serene impassive sea, visible to a width of half the horizon, and meeting the eye with the effect of a vast concave, like the interior of a blue vessel. Detached rocks stood upright afar, a collar of foam girding their bases, and repeating in its whiteness the plumage of a countless multitude of gulls that restlessly hovered about.
"Now, Worm," said Mr. Swancourt sharply, and Worm started into an attitude of attention at once to receive orders. Stephen and himself were then left in possession, and the work went on till early in the afternoon, when dinner was announced by Unity of the vicarage kitchen running up the hill without a bonnet. Elfride did not make her appearance inside the building till late in the afternoon, and came then by special invitation from Stephen during dinner. She looked so intensely living and full of movement as she came into the old silent place, that young Smith's world began to be lit by the purple light in all its definiteness. Worm was got rid of by sending him to measure the height of the tower. What could she do but come close, so close that a minute arc of her skirt touched his foot, and asked him how he was getting on with his sketches, and set herself to learn the principles of practical mensuration as applied to irregular buildings. Then she must ascend the pulpit to reimagine for the 100th time how it would seem to be a preacher. Presently she leant over the front of the pulpit. "Don't you tell Papa, will you, Mr. Smith, if I tell you something?" she said with a sudden impulse to make a confidence.
"Oh no, that I won't," said he, staring up. "Well, I write Papa's sermons for him very often, and he preaches them better than he does his own, and then afterwards he talks to people and to me about what he said in his sermon today, and forgets that I wrote it for him. Isn't it absurd?"
"How clever you must be," said Stephen. "I couldn't write a sermon for the world."
"Oh, it's easy enough," she said, descending from the pulpit and coming close to him to explain more vividly. "You do it like this. Did you ever play a game of forfeits called When Is It? Where Is It? What Is It?"
"No, never."
"Ah, that's a pity, because writing a sermon is very much like playing that game. You take the text. You think, why is it? What is it? And so on. You put that down under generally. Then you proceed to the first, secondly, and thirdly. Papa won't have fourthly, says they are all my eye. Then you have a final collectively, several pages of this being put in great black brackets, writing opposite, leave this out if the farmers are falling asleep. Then comes your in conclusion, then a few words and I have done. Well, all this time you have put on the back of each page, keep your voice down, I mean," she added, correcting herself, "that's how I do in Papa's sermon book, because otherwise he gets louder and louder, till at last he shouts like a farmer up a field. Oh, Papa is so funny in some things." Then, after this childish burst of confidence, she was frightened, as if warned by womanly instinct, which for the moment her ardor had outrun, that she had been too forward to a comparative stranger. Elfride saw her father then, and went away into the wind, being caught by a gust as she ascended the churchyard slope, in which gust she had the motions, without the motives, of a hoyden, the grace, without the self-consciousness, of a pirouetter. She conversed for a minute or two with her father, and proceeded homeward, Mr. Swancourt coming on to the church to Stephen. The wind had freshened his warm complexion as it freshens the glow of a brand. He was in a mood of jollity, and watched Elfride down the hill with a smile. "You little flyaway. You look wild enough now," he said, and turned to Stephen. "But she's not a wild child at all, Mr. Smith. As steady as you, and that you are steady I see from your diligence here." "I think Miss Swancourt very clever," Stephen observed. "Yes, she is, certainly, she is," said Papa, turning his voice as much as possible to the neutral tone of disinterested criticism. "Now, Smith, I'll tell you something, but she mustn't know it for the world, not for the world, mind, for she insists upon keeping it a dead secret. Why, she writes my sermons for me often, and a very good job she makes of them. She can do anything. She can do that. The little rascal has the very trick of the trade. But, mind you, Smith, not a word about it to her, not a single word." "Not a word," said Smith. "Look there," said Mr. Swancourt. "What do you think of my roofing?" He pointed with his walking stick at the chancel roof. "Did you do that, sir?" "Yes, I worked in shirt sleeves all the time that was going on. I pulled down the old rafters, fixed the new ones, put on the battens, slated the roof, all with my own hands, Worm being my assistant. We worked like slaves, didn't we, Worm?"
"Eh, sure, we did, harder than some here and there he, said William Worm, cropping up from somewhere. "Like slaves, I believe he. And weren't ye foaming mad, sir, when the nails wouldn't go straight? Mighty I. There, 'tisn't so bad to cuss and keep it in as to cuss and let it out, is it, sir?"
"Well, why?"
"Because you, sir, when you were a putting on the roof, only used to cuss in your mind, which is, I suppose, no harm at all."
"I don't think you know what goes on in my mind, Worm."
"Oh, don't I, sir he. Maybe I'm but a poor wambling thing, sir, and can't read much, but I can spell as well as some here and there. Don't ye mind, sir, that blusterous night when ye asked me to hold the candle to ye in your workshop, when you were making a new chair for the chancel?"
"Yes, what of that?"
"I stood with the candle, and you said you liked company, if 'twas only a dog or cat manning me, and the chair wouldn't do no how."
"Ah, I remember."
"No, the chair wouldn't do no how. A was very well to look at, but, Lord. Dash.
Worm, how often have I corrected you for irreverent speaking?
A was very well to look at, but you couldn't sit in the chair no how. 'Twas all a twist why the chair, like the letter Z, directly you sat down upon the chair. Get up, Worm, says you, when you see the chair go all a sway why me. Up you took the chair, and flung in like fire and brimstone to t'other end of your shop all in a passion. Damn the chair, says I.
Just what I was thinking, says you, sir. I could see it in your face, sir, says I, and I hope you and God will forgive me for saying what you wouldn't. To save your life you couldn't help laughing, sir, at a poor wambler reading your thoughts so plain. Eh, I'm as wise as one here and there.
I thought you had better have a practical man to go over the church and tower with you, Mr. Swancourt said to Stephen the following morning, so I got Lord Loxilian's permission to send for a man when you came. I told him to be there at 10 o'clock. He's a very intelligent man, and he will tell you all you want to know about the state of the walls. His name is John Smith. Elfride did not like to be seen again at the church with Stephen. "I will watch here for your appearance at the top of the tower," she said laughingly. "I shall see your figure against the sky. And when I am up there I'll wave my handkerchief to you, Miss Swancourt," said Stephen. "In 12 minutes from this present moment," he added, looking at his watch, "I'll be at the summit and look out for you." She went round to the corner of the shrubbery, when she could watch him down the slope leading to the foot of the hill on which the church stood. There she saw waiting for him a white spot a mason in his working clothes. Stephen met this man and stopped. To her surprise, instead of their moving onto the churchyard, they both leisurely sat down upon a stone close by their meeting place, and remained as if in deep conversation. Elfride looked at the time, 9 of the 12 minutes had passed, and Stephen showed no signs of moving. More minutes passed she grew cold with waiting, and shivered.
It was not till the end of a quarter of an hour that they began to slowly wend up the hill at a snail's pace.
Rude and unmannerly, she said to herself, coloring with pique. Anybody would think he was in love with that horrid Mason instead of with.
The sentence remained unspoken, though not unthought. She returned to the porch.
Is the man you sent for a lazy, sit still, do nothing kind of man? She inquired of her father.
No, he said surprised, quite the reverse. He is Lord Luxellian's master mason, John Smith.
Oh, said Elfride indifferently, and returned towards her bleak station, and waited and shivered again. It was a trifle, after all, a childish thing looking out from a tower and waving a handkerchief. But her new friend had promised, and why should he tease her so? The effect of a blow is as proportionate to the texture of the object struck as to its own momentum, and she had such a superlative capacity for being wounded that little hit struck her hard. It was not till the end of half an hour that two figures were seen above the parapet of the dreary old pile, motionless as bitterns on a ruined mosque. Even then Stephen was not true enough to perform what he was so courteous to promise, and he vanished without making a sign. He returned at midday. Elfride looked vexed when unconscious that his eyes were upon her, when conscious, severe. However, her attitude of coldness had long outlived the coldness itself, and she could no longer utter feigned words of indifference.
Ah, you weren't kind to keep me waiting in the cold, and break your promise, she said at last reproachfully, in tones too low for her father's powers of hearing.
Forgive, forgive me, said Stephen with dismay. I had forgotten, quite forgotten. Something prevented my remembering.
Any further explanation? Said Miss Capricious, pouting.
He was silent for a few minutes, and looked askance.
None, he said, with the accent of one who concealed a sin.
Chapter 5. Bosomed high in tufted trees. It was breakfast time. As seen from the vicarage dining room, which took a warm tone of light from the fire, the weather and scene outside seemed to have stereotyped themselves in unrelieved shades of grey. The long-armed trees and shrubs of juniper, cedar, and pine varieties, were greyish-black, those of the broad-leaved sort, together with the herbage, were greyish-green, the eternal hills and tower behind them were greyish-brown, the sky, dropping behind all, grey of the purest melancholy. Yet in spite of this somber artistic effect, the morning was not one which tended to lower the spirits. It was even cheering. For it did not rain, nor was rain likely to fall for many days to come. Elfride had turned from the table towards the fire and was idly elevating a hand screen before her face, when she heard the click of a little gate outside.
Ah, here's the postman, she said, as a shuffling, active man came through an opening in the shrubbery and across the lawn. She vanished, and met him in the porch, afterwards coming in with her hands behind her back.
How many are there?
Three for Papa, one for Mr. Smith, none for Miss Swancourt.
And, Papa, look here. One of yours is from whom do you think?
Lord Luxellian. And it has something hard in it, a lump of something. I've been feeling it through the envelope, and can't think what it is.
What does Luxellian write for, I wonder?
Mr. Swancourt had said simultaneously with her words. He handed Stephen his letter, and took his own, putting on his countenance a higher class of look than was customary, as became a poor gentleman who was going to read a letter from a peer. Stephen read his missive with a countenance quite the reverse of the vicar's.
Percy Place, Thursday evening. Dear Smith, old age is in a towering rage with you for being so long about the church sketches. Swears you are more trouble than you are worth. He says I am to write and say you are to stay no longer on any consideration that he would have done it all in 3 hours very easily. I told him that you were not like an experienced hand, which he seemed to forget, but it did not make much difference. However, between you and me privately, if I were you I would not alarm myself for a day or so. If I were not inclined to return, I would make out the week and finish my spree. He will blow up just as much if you appear here on Saturday as if you keep away till Monday morning. Yours very truly.
Simpkins Jenkins.
Dear me, very awkward, said Stephen, rather en l'air, and confused with the kind of confusion that assails an understrapper when he has been enlarged by accident to the dimensions of a superior, and is somewhat rudely pared down to his original size.
What is awkward? Said Miss Swancourt.
Smith by this time recovered his equanimity, and with it the professional dignity of an experienced architect. Important business demands my immediate presence in London, I regret to say, he replied.
What? Must you go at once? Said Mr. Swancourt, looking over the edge of his letter.
Important business?
a young fellow like you to have important business.
The truth is, said Stephen blushing, and rather ashamed of having pretended even so slightly to a consequence which did not belong to him, the truth is, Mr. Hubby has sent to say I am to come home, and I must obey him.
I see, I see. It is politic to do so, you mean. Now I can see more than you think. You are to be his partner. I booked you for that directly I read his letter to me the other day, and the way he spoke of you. He thinks a great deal of you, Mr. Smith, or he wouldn't be so anxious for your return.
Unpleasant to Stephen such remarks as these could not sound, to have the expectancy of partnership with one of the largest practicing architects in London thrust upon him was cheering, however untenable he felt the idea to be. He saw that, whatever Mr. Hubby might think, Mr. Swancourt certainly thought much of him to entertain such an idea on such slender ground as to be absolutely no ground at all. And then, unaccountably, his speaking face exhibited a cloud of sadness, which a reflection on the remoteness of any such contingency could hardly have sufficed to cause. Alfred was struck with that look of his, even Mr. Swancourt noticed it.
Well, he said cheerfully, never mind that now. You must come again on your own account, not on business. Come to see me as a visitor, you know, say, in your holidays all you townmen have holidays like schoolboys. When are they?
In August, I believe.
Very well, come in August, and then you need not hurry away so. I am glad to get somebody decent to talk to, or at, in this outlandish Ultima Thule. But, by the by, I have something to say you won't go today?
No, I need not, said Stephen hesitatingly. I am not obliged to get back before Monday morning.
Very well, then, that brings me to what I am going to propose. This is a letter from Lord Luxellian. I think you heard me speak of him as the resident landowner in this district, and patron of this living?
I know of him. He is in London now. It seems that he has run up on business for a day or two, and taken Lady Luxellian with him. He has written to ask me to go to his house, and search for a paper among his private memoranda, which he forgot to take with him.
What did he send in the letter?
Inquired Elfried.
The key of a private desk in which the papers are. He doesn't like to trust such a matter to anybody else. I have done such things for him before. And what I propose is, that we make an afternoon of it all three of us. Go for a drive to Targan Bay, come home by way of Endelstow House, and whilst I am looking over the documents you can ramble about the rooms where you like. I have the run of the house at any time, you know. The building, though nothing but a mass of gables outside, has a splendid hall, staircase, and gallery within, and there are a few good pictures.
Yes, there are, said Stephen.
Have you seen the place, then?
I saw it as I came by, he said hastily.
Oh yes, but I was alluding to the interior. And the Church Street of Ales is much older than our St. Agnes here. I do duty in that and this alternately, you know. The fact is, I ought to have some help. Riding across that park for 2 miles on a wet morning is not at all the thing. If my constitution were not well seasoned, as thank God it is, comma here Mr. Swancourt looked down his front, as if his constitution were visible there, I should be coughing and barking all the year round. And when the family goes away, there are only about 3 servants to preach to when I get there.
Well, that shall be the arrangement, then.
Elfride, you will like to go?
Elfride assented, and the little breakfast party separated. Stephen rose to go and take a few final measurements at the church, the vicar following him to the door with a mysterious expression of inquiry on his face.
You'll put up with our not having family prayer this morning, I hope? He whispered.
Yes, quite so, said Stephen.
To tell you the truth, he continued in the same undertone, we don't make a regular thing of it, but when we have strangers visiting us, I'm strongly of opinion that it is the proper thing to do, and I always do it. I'm very strict on that point. But you, Smith, there is something in your face which makes me feel quite at home, no nonsense about you, in short.
Ah, it reminds me of a splendid story I used to hear when I was a helter-skelter young fellow, such a story. But here the vicar shook his head self-forbiddingly, and grimly laughed.
Was it a good story? Said young Smith, smiling too.
Oh yes, but 'tis too bad, too bad. Couldn't tell it to you for the world.
Stephen went across the lawn, hearing the vicar chuckling privately at the recollection as he withdrew. They started at 3 o'clock. The grey morning had resolved itself into an afternoon bright with a pale pervasive sunlight, without the sun itself being visible. Lightly they trotted along, the wheels nearly silent, the horses' hoofs clapping, almost ringing, upon the hard, white,
Turnpike Road as it followed the level ridge in a perfectly straight line, seeming to be absorbed ultimately by the white of the sky. Targan Bay, which had the merit of being easily got at, was duly visited. They then swept round by innumerable lanes, in which not 20 consecutive yards were either straight or level, to the domain of Lord Luxellian. A woman with a double chin and thick neck, like Queen Anne by Dahl, threw open the lodge gate, a little boy standing behind her.
"I'll give him something, poor little fellow," said Elfried, pulling out her purse and hastily opening it. From the interior of her purse a host of bits of paper, like a flock of white birds, floated into the air, and were blown about in all directions.
"Well, to be sure," said Stephen with a slight laugh.
"What the dickens is all that?" said Mr. Swancourt.
"Not halves of banknotes, Elfried?"
Elfried looked annoyed and guilty.
"They are only something of mine, Papa," she faltered, while Stephen leapt out, and, assisted by the lodgekeeper's little boy, crept about round the wheels and horses' hoofs till the papers were all gathered together again. He handed them back to her, and remounted.
"I suppose you are wondering what those scraps were?" she said, as they bowled along up the Sycamore Avenue. "And so I may as well tell you. They are notes for a romance I am writing." She could not help coloring at the confession, much as she tried to avoid it.
"A story, do you mean?" said Stephen, Mr. Swancourt half listening, and catching a word of the conversation now and then.
"Yes, the Court of Kellion Castle, a romance of the 15th century. Such writing is out of date now, I know, but I like doing it.
A romance carried in a purse. If a highwayman were to rob you, he would be taken in."
"Yes, that's my way of carrying manuscript. The real reason is, that I mostly write bits of it on scraps of paper when I am on horseback, and I put them there for convenience."
"What are you going to do with your romance when you have written it?" said Stephen.
"I don't know," she replied, and turned her head to look at the prospect. For by this time they had reached the precincts of Endelstow House. Driving through an ancient gateway of dun-colored stone, spanned by the high-shouldered Tudor arch, they found themselves in a spacious court, closed by a facade on each of its three sides. The substantial portions of the existing building dated from the reign of Henry VIII, but the picturesque and sheltered spot had been the site of an erection of a much earlier date. A license to crenellate mansum inframanerium suum was granted by Edward II to Hugo Luxellian Chevalier, but though the faint outline of the ditch and mound was visible at points, no sign of the original building remained. The windows on all sides were long and many-mullioned, the roof lines broken up by dormer lights of the same pattern. The apex stones of these dormers, together with those of the gables, were surmounted by grotesque figures in rampant, passant, and couchant variety. Tall octagonal and twisted chimneys thrust themselves high up into the sky, surpassed in height, however, by some poplars and sycamores at the back, which showed their gently rocking summits over ridge and parapet. In the corners of the court polygonal bays, whose surfaces were entirely occupied by buttresses and windows, broke into the squareness of the enclosure, and a far-projecting oriel, springing from a fantastic series of mouldings, overhung the archway of the chief entrance to the house. As Mr. Swancourt had remarked, he had the freedom of the mansion in the absence of its owner. Upon a statement of his errand they were all admitted to the library, and left entirely to themselves. Mr. Swancourt was soon up to his eyes in the examination of a heap of papers he had taken from the cabinet described by his correspondent. Stephen and Elfride had nothing to do but to wander about till her father was ready. Elfride entered the gallery, and Stephen followed her without seeming to do so. It was a long somber apartment, enriched with fittings a century or so later in style than the walls of the mansion. Pilasters of Renaissance workmanship supported a cornice from which sprang a curved ceiling, paneled in the awkward twists and curls of the period. The old Gothic quarry still remained in the upper portion of the large window at the end, though they had made way for a more modern form of glazing elsewhere. Stephen was at one end of the gallery looking towards Elfride, who stood in the midst, beginning to feel somewhat depressed by the society of Luxellian shades of cadaverous complexion fixed by Holbein, Kneller, and Lely, and seeming to gaze at and through her in a moralizing mood. The silence, which cast almost a spell upon them, was broken by the sudden opening of a door at the far end. Out bounded a pair of little girls, lightly yet warmly dressed. Their eyes were sparkling, their hair swinging about and around, their red mouths laughing with unalloyed gladness.
"Ah, Mississippi Swancourt, dearest Delphi. We heard you. Are you going to stay here? You are our little mama, are you not? Our big mama is gone to London," said one.
"Let me tiss you," said the other,
in appearance very much like the first, but to a smaller pattern. Their pink cheeks and yellow hair were speedily intermingled with the folds of Elfride's dress. She then stooped and tenderly embraced them both.
"Such an odd thing," said Elfride, smiling, and turning to Stephen. "They have taken it into their heads lately to call me Little Mama, because I am very fond of them, and wore a dress the other day something like one of Lady Loxilian's."
These two young creatures were the Honorable Mary and the Honorable Kate, scarcely appearing large enough as yet to bear the weight of such ponderous prefixes. They were the only two children of Lord and Lady Loxilian, and, as it proved, had been left at home during their parents' temporary absence, in the custody of nurse and governess. Lord Loxilian was dotingly fond of the children, rather indifferent towards his wife, since she had begun to show an inclination not to please him by giving him a boy. All children instinctively ran after Elfride, looking upon her more as an unusually nice large specimen of their own tribe than as a grown-up elder. It had now become an established rule that whenever she met them indoors or out of doors, weekdays or Sundays, they were to be severally pressed against her face and bosom for the space of a quarter of a minute, and otherwise made much of on the delightful system of cumulative epithet and caress to which unpracticed girls will occasionally abandon themselves. A look of misgiving by the youngsters towards the door by which they had entered directed attention to a maidservant appearing from the same quarter, to put an end to the sweet freedom of the poor Honorables Mary and Kate.
"I wish you lived here, Miss Swancourt," piped one like a melancholy bullfinch.
"So do I," piped the other like a rather more melancholy bullfinch. "Mama can't play with us so nicely as you do. I don't think she ever learnt playing when she was little. When shall we come to see you?"
"As soon as you like, dears."
"And sleep at your house all night?
That's what I mean by coming to see you. I don't care to see people with hats and bonnets on, and all standing up and walking about.
As soon as we can get Mama's permission, you shall come and stay as long as ever you like. Goodbye."
The prisoners were then led off, Elfride again turning her attention to her guest, whom she had left standing at the remote end of the gallery. On looking around for him, he was nowhere to be seen. Elfride stepped down to the library, thinking he might have rejoined her father there. But Mr. Swancourt, now cheerfully illuminated by a pair of candles, was still alone, untying packets of letters and papers, and tying them up again. As Elfride did not stand on a sufficiently intimate footing with the object of her interest to justify her, as a proper young lady, to commence the active search for him that youthful impulsiveness prompted, and as, nevertheless, for a nascent reason connected with those divinely cut lips of his, she did not like him to be absent from her side, she wandered desultorily back to the oak staircase, pouting and casting her eyes about in hope of discerning his boyish figure. Though daylight still prevailed in the rooms, the corridors were in a depth of shadow chill, sad, and silent, and it was only by looking along them towards light spaces beyond that anything or anybody could be discerned therein. One of these light spots she found to be caused by a side door with glass panels in the upper part. Elfride opened it, and found herself confronting a secondary or inner lawn, separated from the principal lawn front by a shrubbery. And now she saw a perplexing sight. At right angles to the face of the wing she had emerged from, and within a few feet of the door, jutted out another wing of the mansion, lower and with less architectural character. Immediately opposite to her, in the wall of this wing, was a large broad window, having its blind drawn down, and illuminated by a light in the room it screened. On the blind was a shadow from somebody close inside it, a person in profile. The profile was unmistakably that of Stephen. It was just possible to see that his arms were uplifted, and that his hands held an article of some kind. Then another shadow appeared also in profile and came close to him. This was the shadow of a woman. She turned her back towards Stephen. He lifted and held out what now proved to be a shawl or mantle, placed it carefully so carefully round the lady, disappeared, reappeared in her front, fastened the mantle. Did he then kiss her? Surely not. Yet the motion might have been a kiss. Then both shadows swelled to colossal dimensions, grew distorted, vanished. 2 minutes elapsed.
"Ah, Mississippi Swancourt. I'm so glad to find you. I was looking for you," said a voice at her elbow, Stephen's voice. She stepped into the passage.
"Do you know any of the members of this establishment?" said she.
"Not a single one, how should I?" he replied.
Chapter 6. Fare thee wheel a while. Simultaneously with the conclusion of Stephen's remark, the sound of the closing of an external door in their immediate neighborhood reached Elfride's ears. It came from the further side of the wing containing the illuminated room. She then discerned, by the aid of the dusky departing light, a figure, whose sex was undistinguishable,
walking down the graveled path by the parterre towards the river. The figure grew fainter, and vanished under the trees. Mr. Swancourt's voice was heard calling out their names from a distant corridor in the body of the building. They retraced their steps, and found him with his coat buttoned up and his hat on, awaiting their advent in a mood of self-satisfaction at having brought his search to a successful close. The carriage was brought round, and without further delay the trio drove away from the mansion, under the echoing gateway arch, and along by the leafless sycamores, as the stars began to kindle their trembling lights behind the maze of branches and twigs. No words were spoken either by youth or maiden. Her unpracticed mind was completely occupied in fathoming its recent acquisition. The young man who had inspired her with such novelty of feeling, who had come directly from London on business to her father, having been brought by chance to Endelstow House, had, by some means or other, acquired the privilege of approaching some lady he had found therein, and of honoring her by petit soin of a marked kind, all in the space of half an hour. What room were they standing in? Thought Elfride. As nearly as she could guess, it was Lord Luxellian's business room, or office. What people were in the house? None but the governess and servants, as far as she knew, and of these he had professed a total ignorance. Had the person she had indistinctly seen leaving the house anything to do with the performance? It was impossible to say without appealing to the culprit himself, and that she would never do. The more Elfride reflected, the more certain did it appear that the meeting was a chance encounter, and not an appointment. On the ultimate inquiry as to the individuality of the woman, Elfride at once assumed that she could not be an inferior. Stephen Smith was not the man to care about passages at love with women beneath him. Though gentle, ambition was visible in his kindling eyes. He evidently hoped for much, hoped indefinitely, but extensively. Elfride was puzzled, and being puzzled, was, by a natural sequence of girlish sensations, vexed with him. No more pleasure came in recognizing that from liking to attract him she was getting on to love him, boyish as he was and innocent as he had seemed. They reached the bridge which formed a link between the eastern and western halves of the parish. Situated in a valley that was bounded outwardly by the sea, it formed a point of depression from which the road ascended with great steepness to West Endelstow and the vicarage. There was no absolute necessity for either of them to alight, but as it was the vicar's custom after a long journey to humor the horse in making this winding ascent, Elfride, moved by an imitative instinct, suddenly jumped out when Pleasant had just begun to adopt the deliberate stalk he associated with this portion of the road. The young man seemed glad of any excuse for breaking the silence. "Why, Miss Swancourt, what a risky thing to do!" he exclaimed, immediately following her example by jumping down on the other side. "Oh no, not at all," replied she coldly, the shadow phenomenon at Endelstow House still paramount within her. Stephen walked along by himself for 2 or 3 minutes, wrapped in the rigid reserve dictated by her tone. Then apparently thinking that it was only for girls to pout, he came serenely round to her side, and offered his arm with Castilian gallantry, to assist her in ascending the remaining 3/4 of the steep. Here was a temptation. It was the first time in her life that Elfride had been treated as a grown-up woman in this way, offered an arm in a manner implying that she had a right to refuse it. Till tonight she had never received masculine attentions beyond those which might be contained in such homely remarks as "Elfride, give me your hand, Elfride, take hold of my arm," from her father. Her callow heart made an epic of the incident. She considered her array of feelings, for and against. Collectively they were for taking this offered arm, the single one of pique determined her to punish Stephen by refusing. "No, thank you, Mr. Smith, I can get along better by myself." It was Elfride's first fragile attempt at browbeating a lover. Fearing more the issue of such an undertaking than what a gentle young man might think of her waywardness, she immediately afterwards determined to please herself by reversing her statement. "On second thoughts, I will take it," she said. They slowly went their way up the hill, a few yards behind the carriage. "How silent you are, Miss Swancourt," Stephen observed. "Perhaps I think you silent too," she returned. "I may have reason to be." "Scarcely, it is sadness that makes people silent, and you can have none." "You don't know, I have a trouble, though some might think it less a trouble than a dilemma." "What is it?" she asked impulsively. Stephen hesitated. "I might tell," he said, "at the same time, perhaps, it is as well." She let go his arm and imperatively pushed it from her, tossing her head. She had just learned that a good deal of dignity is lost by asking a question to which an answer is refused, even ever so politely, for though politeness does good service in cases of requisition and compromise, it but little helps a direct refusal. I don't wish to know anything of it, I don't wish it, she went on. The carriage is waiting for us at the top of the hill, we must get in, and Alfred flitted to the front.
Papa, here is your Alfred. She exclaimed to the dusky figure of the old gentleman, as she sprang up and sank by his side without deigning to accept aid from Stephen.
Ah, yes. Uttered the vicar in artificially alert tones, awaking from a most profound sleep, and suddenly preparing to alight.
Why, what are you doing, Papa? We are not home yet.
Oh no, no, of course not, we are not at home yet, Mr. Swancourt said very hastily, endeavoring to dodge back to his original position with the air of a man who had not moved at all. The fact is I was so lost in deep meditation that I forgot whereabouts we were. And in a minute the vicar was snoring again. That evening, being the last, seemed to throw an exceptional shade of sadness over Stephen Smith, and the repeated injunctions of the vicar, that he was to come and revisit them in the summer, apparently tended less to raise his spirits than to unearth some misgiving. He left them in the grey light of dawn, whilst the colours of earth were sombre, and the sun was yet hidden in the east. Elfride had fidgeted all night in her little bed lest none of the household should be awake soon enough to start him, and also lest she might miss seeing again the bright eyes and curly hair, to which their owner's possession of a hidden mystery added a deeper tinge of romance. To some extent so soon does womanly interest take a solicitous turn she felt herself responsible for his safe conduct. They breakfasted before daylight, Mr. Swancourt, being more and more taken with his guest's ingenuous appearance, having determined to rise early and bid him a friendly farewell. It was, however, rather to the vicar's astonishment, that he saw Alfred walk into the breakfast table, candle in hand. Whilst William Worm performed his toilet, during which performance the inmates of the vicarage were always in the habit of waiting with exemplary patience, Alfred wandered desultorily to the summer house. Stephen followed her thither. The copse-covered valley was visible from this position, a mist now lying all along its length, hiding the stream which trickled through it, though the observers themselves were in clear air. They stood close together, leaning over the rustic balustrading which bounded the arbor on the outward side, and formed the crest of a steep slope beneath. Alfred constrainedly pointed out some features of the distant uplands rising irregularly opposite. But the artistic eye was, either from nature or circumstance, very faint in Stephen now, and he only half attended to her description, as if he spared time from some other thought going on within him.
Well, goodbye, he said suddenly, I must never see you again, I suppose, Miss Swancourt, in spite of invitations. His genuine tribulation played directly upon the delicate chords of her nature. She could afford to forgive him for a concealment or two. Moreover, the shyness which would not allow him to look her in the face lent bravery to her own eyes and tongue.
Oh, do come again, Mr. Smith, she said prettily. I should delight in it, but it will be better if I do not.
Why?
Certain circumstances in connection with me make it undesirable. Not on my account, on yours.
Goodness. As if anything in connection with you could hurt me, she said with serene supremacy, but seeing that this plan of treatment was inappropriate, she tuned a smaller note.
Ah, I know why you will not come. You don't want to. You'll go home to London and to all the stirring people there, and will never want to see us any more.
You know I have no such reason.
And go on writing letters to the lady you are engaged to, just as before.
What does that mean?
I am not engaged.
You wrote a letter to a Miss Somebody, I saw it in the letter rack.
Pooh. An elderly woman who keeps a stationer's shop, and it was to tell her to keep my newspapers till I get back.
You needn't have explained, it was not my business at all.
Miss Alfred was rather relieved to hear that statement, nevertheless.
And you won't come again to see my father? She insisted.
I should like to and to see you again, but...
Will you reveal to me that matter you hide? She interrupted petulantly.
No, not now.
She could not but go on, graceless as it might seem.
Tell me this, she importuned with a trembling mouth. Does any meeting of yours with a lady at Endelstow Vicarage clash with any interest you may take in me?
He started a little.
It does not, he said emphatically, and looked into the pupils of her eyes with a confidence that only honesty can give, and even that to youth alone.
The explanation had not come, but a gloom left her. She could not but believe that utterance. Whatever enigma might lie in the shadow on the blind, it was not an enigma of underhand passion. She turned towards the house, entering it through the conservatory. Stephen went round to the front door. Mr. Swancourt was standing on the step in his slippers. Worm was adjusting a buckle on the harness, and murmuring about his poor head,
and everything was ready for Stephen's departure.
You named August for your visit.
August it shall be, that is, if you care for the society of such a fossilized Tory, said Mr. Swancourt.
Mr. Smith only responded hesitatingly, that he should like to come again.
You said you would, and you must, insisted Elfride, coming to the door and speaking under her father's arm.
Whatever reason the youth may have had for not wishing to enter the house as a guest, it no longer predominated. He promised, and bade them adieu, and got into the pony carriage, which crept up the slope, and bore him out of their sight.
I never was so much taken with anybody in my life as I am with that young fellow, never.
I cannot understand it, can't understand it anyhow, said Mr. Swancourt quite energetically to himself, and went indoors. Chapter 7. No more of me you knew, my love.
Stephen Smith revisited Endelstow Vicarage, agreeably to his promise. He had a genuine artistic reason for coming, though no such reason seemed to be required. 36 old seat ends, of exquisite 15th-century workmanship, were rapidly decaying in an aisle of the church, and it became politic to make drawings of their worm-eaten contours ere they were battered past recognition in the turmoil of the so-called Restoration. He entered the house at sunset, and the world was pleasant again to the two fair-haired ones. A momentary pang of disappointment had, nevertheless, passed through Elfride when she casually discovered that he had not come that minute post-haste from London, but had reached the neighborhood the previous evening. Surprise would have accompanied the feeling, had she not remembered that several tourists were haunting the coast at this season, and that Stephen might have chosen to do likewise. They did little besides chat that evening, Mr. Swancourt beginning to question his visitor, closely yet paternally, and in good part, on his hopes and prospects from the profession he had embraced. Stephen gave vague answers. The next day it rained. In the evening, when 24 hours of Elfride had completely rekindled her admirer's ardor, a game of chess was proposed between them. The game had its value in helping on the developments of their future. Elfride soon perceived that her opponent was but a learner. She next noticed that he had a very odd way of handling the pieces when castling or taking a man. Antecedently she would have supposed that the same performance must be gone through by all players in the same manner. She was taught by his differing action that all ordinary players, who learn the game by sight, unconsciously touch the men in a stereotyped way. This impression of indescribable oddness in Stephen's touch culminated in speech when she saw him, at the taking of one of her bishops, push it aside with the taking man instead of lifting it as a preliminary to the move.
How strangely you handle the men, Mr. Smith.
Do I?
I am sorry for that.
Oh no, don't be sorry, it is not a matter great enough for sorrow. But who taught you to play?
Nobody, Mississippi Swancourt, he said. I learned from a book lent me by my friend Mr. Knight, the noblest man in the world.
But you have seen people play?
I have never seen the playing of a single game. This is the first time I ever had the opportunity of playing with a living opponent. I have worked out many games from books, and studied the reasons of the different moves, but that is all. This was a full explanation of his mannerism. But the fact that a man with the desire for chess should have grown up without being able to see or engage in a game astonished her not a little. She pondered on the circumstance for some time, looking into vacancy and hindering the play. Mr. Swancourt was sitting with his eyes fixed on the board, but apparently thinking of other things. Half to himself he said, pending the move of Elfride.
Quae finis aut quod me manae stipendium?
Stephen replied instantly.
Ifer, just as cum fidei penis luam.
Excellent prompt gratifying, said Mr. Swancourt with feeling, bringing down his hand upon the table, and making three pawns and a knight dance over their borders by the shaking. I was musing on those words as applicable to a strange course I am steering, but enough of that. I am delighted with you, Mr. Smith, for it is so seldom in this desert that I meet with a man who is gentleman and scholar enough to continue a quotation, however trite it may be.
I also apply the words to myself, said Stephen quietly.
You? The last man in the world to do that, I should have thought.
Come, murmured Elfride pattingly, and insinuating herself between them, tell me all about it.
Come, construe, construe.
Stephen looked steadfastly into her face, and said slowly, and in a voice full of a far-off meaning that seemed quaintly premature in one so young.
Quae finis what will be the end, outdoor, quod stipendium what fine, manami awaits me? If e'er speak out, luam I will pay. Cum fidei with faith, just as penis the penalty required.
The vicar,
who had listened with a critical compression of the lips to this schoolboy recitation, and by reason of his imperfect hearing had missed the marked realism of Stephen's tone in the English words, now said hesitatingly, "By the by, Mr. Smith, I know you'll excuse my curiosity, though your translation was unexceptionably correct and close, you have a way of pronouncing your Latin which to me seems most peculiar. Not that the pronunciation of a dead language is of much importance, yet your accents and quantities have a grotesque sound to my ears. I thought first that you had acquired your way of breathing the vowels from some of the northern colleges, but it cannot be so with the quantities. What I was going to ask was, if your instructor in the classics could possibly have been an Oxford or Cambridge man?"
"Yes, he was an Oxford man, fellow of St. Cyprian's."
"Really?"
"Oh yes, there's no doubt about it."
"The oddest thing ever I heard of," said Mr. Swancourt, starting with astonishment. "That the pupil of such a man."
"The best and cleverest man in England," cried Stephen enthusiastically.
"That the pupil of such a man should pronounce Latin in the way you pronounce it beats all I ever heard. How long did he instruct you?"
"4 years."
"4 years. It is not so strange when I explain," Stephen hastened to say. "It was done in this way by letter. I sent him exercises and construing twice a week, and twice a week he sent them back to me corrected, with marginal notes of instruction. That is how I learnt my Latin and Greek, such as it is. He is not responsible for my scanning. He has never heard me scan a line."
"A novel case, and a singular instance of patience," cried the vicar.
"On his part, not on mine. Ah, Henry Knight is one in a thousand. I remember his speaking to me on this very subject of pronunciation. He says that, much to his regret, he sees a time coming when every man will pronounce even the common words of his own tongue as seems right in his own ears, and be thought none the worse for it, that the speaking age is passing away, to make room for the writing age." Both Elfride and her father had waited attentively to hear Stephen go on to what would have been the most interesting part of the story, namely, what circumstances could have necessitated such an unusual method of education. But no further explanation was volunteered, and they saw, by the young man's manner of concentrating himself upon the chessboard, that he was anxious to drop the subject. The game proceeded. Elfride played by rote, Stephen by thought. It was the cruelest thing to checkmate him after so much labor, she considered. What was she dishonest enough to do in her compassion? To let him checkmate her. A second game followed, and being herself absolutely indifferent as to the result, her playing was above the average among women, and she knew it, she allowed him to give checkmate again. A final game, in which she adopted the Musio Gambit as her opening, was terminated by Elfride's victory at the 12th move. Stephen looked up suspiciously. His heart was throbbing even more excitedly than was hers, which itself had quickened when she seriously set to work on this last occasion. Mr. Swancourt had left the room.
"You have been trifling with me till now," he exclaimed, his face flushing. "You did not play your best in the first two games?"
Elfride's guilt showed in her face. Stephen became the picture of vexation and sadness, which, relishable for a moment, caused her the next instant to regret the mistake she had made.
"Mr. Smith, forgive me," she said sweetly. "I see now, though I did not at first, that what I have done seems like contempt for your skill. But, indeed, I did not mean it in that sense. I could not, upon my conscience, win a victory in those first and second games over one who fought at such a disadvantage and so manfully." He drew a long breath, and murmured bitterly, "Ah, you are cleverer than I. You can do everything I can do nothing. Oh, Miss Swancourt!" He burst out wildly, his heart swelling in his throat, "I must tell you how I love you. All these months of my absence I have worshipped you." He leapt from his seat like the impulsive lad that he was, slid round to her side, and almost before she suspected it his arm was round her waist, and the two sets of curls intermingled. So entirely new was full-blown love to Elfride, that she trembled as much from the novelty of the emotion as from the emotion itself. Then she suddenly withdrew herself and stood upright, vexed that she had submitted unresistingly even to his momentary pressure. She resolved to consider this demonstration as premature. "You must not begin such things as those," she said with coquettish hauteur of a very transparent nature, "and you must not do so again, and Papa is coming." "Let me kiss you only a little one," he said with his usual delicacy, and without reading the factitiousness of her manner.
"No, not one."
"Only on your cheek?"
"No."
"Forehead?"
"Certainly not."
"You care for somebody else, then?"
"Ah, I thought so."
"I am sure I do not."
Nor for me either?
How can I tell? She said simply, the simplicity lying merely in the broad outlines of her manner and speech. There were the semitone of voice and half-hidden expression of eyes which tell the initiated how very fragile is the ice of reserve at these times. Footsteps were heard. Mr. Swancourt then entered the room, and their private colloquy ended. The day after this partial revelation, Mr. Swancourt proposed a drive to the cliffs beyond Targan Bay, a distance of 3 or 4 miles. Half an hour before the time of departure a crash was heard in the backyard, and presently Worm came in, saying partly to the world in general, partly to himself, and slightly to his auditors.
Sure. That frying of fish will be the end of William Worm. They be at it again this morning same as ever fizz, fizz, fizz.
Your head bad again, Worm? Said Mr. Swancourt. What was that noise we heard in the yard?
Sir, a weak wambling man am I, and the frying have been going on in my poor head all through the long night and this morning as usual, and I was so dazed why it that down fell a piece of legwood across the shaft of the pony shay, and splintered it off.
Says I feel it as if 'twas my own shay, and though I've done it, and parish pay is my lot if I go from here, perhaps I am as independent as one here and there.
Dear me, the shaft of the carriage broken! Cried Elfried. She was disappointed, Stephen doubly so. The vicar showed more warmth of temper than the accident seemed to demand, much to Stephen's uneasiness and rather to his surprise. He had not supposed so much latent sternness could coexist with Mr. Swancourt's frankness and good nature.
You shall not be disappointed, said the vicar at length. It is almost too long a distance for you to walk. Elfride can trot down on her pony, and you shall have my old nag, Smith.
Elfride exclaimed triumphantly, you have never seen me on horseback, oh, you must. She looked at Stephen and read his thoughts immediately.
Ah, you don't ride, Mr. Smith?
I am sorry to say I don't.
Fancy a man not able to ride, said she rather pertly.
The vicar came to his rescue. That's common enough, he has had other lessons to learn. Now, I recommend this plan, let Elfride ride on horseback, and you, Mr. Smith, walk beside her.
The arrangement was welcomed with secret delight by Stephen. It seemed to combine in itself all the advantages of a long slow ramble with Elfride, without the contingent possibility of the enjoyment being spoiled by her becoming weary. The pony was saddled and brought round.
Now, Mr. Smith, said the lady imperatively, coming downstairs, and appearing in her riding habit, as she always did in a change of dress, like a new edition of a delightful volume, you have a task to perform today. These earrings are my very favorite darling ones, but the worst of it is that they have such short hooks that they are liable to be dropped if I toss my head about much, and when I am riding I can't give my mind to them. It would be doing me night service if you keep your eyes fixed upon them, and remember them every minute of the day, and tell me directly I drop one. They have had such hairbreadth escapes, haven't they, Unity? She continued to the parlor maid who was standing at the door.
Yes, miss, that they have, said Unity with round-eyed commiseration.
Once 'twas in the lane that I found one of them, pursued Elfride reflectively.
And then 'twas by the gate into 18 acres, Unity chimed in.
And then 'twas on the carpet in my own room, rejoined Elfride merrily.
And then 'twas dangling on the embroidery of your petticoat, miss, and then 'twas down your back, miss, wasn't it? And oh, what a way you was in, miss, wasn't you? My. Until you found it.
Stephen took Elfride's slight foot upon his hand, 1, 2, 3, and up, she said.
Unfortunately not so. He staggered and lifted, and the horse edged round, and Elfride was ultimately deposited upon the ground rather more forcibly than was pleasant. Smith looked all contrition.
Never mind, said the vicar encouragingly, try again. 'Tis a little accomplishment that requires some practice, although it looks so easy. Stand closer to the horse's head, Mr. Smith.
Indeed, I shan't let him try again, said she with a microscopic look of indignation.
Worm, come here, and help me to mount.
Worm stepped forward, and she was in the saddle in a trice. Then they moved on, going for some distance in silence, the hot air of the valley being occasionally brushed from their faces by a cool breeze, which wound its way along ravines leading up from the sea.
I suppose, said Stephen, that a man who can neither sit in a saddle himself nor help another person into one seems a useless encumbrance, but, Miss Swancourt, I'll learn to do it all for your sake, I will, indeed.
What is so unusual in you, she said, in a didactic tone justifiable in a horsewoman's address to a benighted walker,
is that your knowledge of certain things should be combined with your ignorance of certain other things.
Stephen lifted his eyes earnestly to hers. You know, he said, it is simply because there are so many other things to be learned in this wide world that I didn't trouble about that particular bit of knowledge. I thought it would be useless to me, but I don't think so now. I will learn riding, and all connected with it, because then you would like me better. Do you like me much less for this?
She looked sideways at him with critical meditation tenderly rendered.
Do I seem like La Belle Dame sans merci? She began suddenly, without replying to his question.
Fancy yourself saying, Mr. Smith.
I sat her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all day long, for sidelong would she bend, and sing a fairy's song, she found me roots of relish sweet, and honey wild, and manna dew.
And that's all she did.
No, no, said the young man stilly, and with a rising color.
And sure in language strange she said, I love thee true.
Not at all, she rejoined quickly.
See how I can gallop.
Now, Pansy, off.
And Elfride started, and Stephen beheld her light figure contracting to the dimensions of a bird as she sank into the distance, her hair flowing.
He walked on in the same direction, and for a considerable time could see no signs of her returning.
Dull as a flower without the sun, he sat down upon a stone, and not for 15 minutes was any sound of horse or rider to be heard.
Then Elfride and Pansy appeared on the hill in a round trot.
Such a delightful scamper as we have had, she said, her face flushed and her eyes sparkling.
She turned the horse's head, Stephen arose, and they went on again.
Well, what have you to say to me, Mr. Smith, after my long absence?
Do you remember a question you could not exactly answer last night, whether I was more to you than anybody else? Said he.
I cannot exactly answer now, either.
Why can't you?
Because I don't know if I am more to you than anyone else.
Yes, indeed, you are.
He exclaimed in a voice of intensest appreciation, at the same time gliding round and looking into her face.
Eyes and eyes, he murmured playfully, and she blushingly obeyed, looking back into his.
And why not lips on lips? Continued Stephen daringly.
No, certainly not. Anybody might look, and it would be the death of me.
You may kiss my hand if you like.
He expressed by a look that to kiss a hand through a glove, and that a riding glove, was not a great treat under the circumstances.
There, then, I'll take my glove off.
Isn't it a pretty white hand?
Ah, you don't want to kiss it, and you shall not now.
If I do not, may I never kiss again, you severe Elfride.
You know I think more of you than I can tell, that you are my queen.
I would die for you, Elfride.
A rapid red again filled her cheeks, and she looked at him meditatively.
What a proud moment it was for Elfride then. She was ruling a heart with absolute despotism for the first time in her life.
Stephen stealthily pounced upon her hand.
No, I won't, I won't. She said intractably, and you shouldn't take me by surprise.
There ensued a mild form of tussle for absolute possession of the much-coveted hand, in which the boisterousness of boy and girl was far more prominent than the dignity of man and woman. Then Pansy became restless. Elfride recovered her position and remembered herself.
You make me behave in not a nice way at all, she exclaimed, in a tone neither of pleasure nor anger, but partaking of both.
I ought not to have allowed such a romp. We are too old now for that sort of thing.
I hope you don't think me too much of a creeping round sort of man, said he in a penitent tone, conscious that he too had lost a little dignity by the proceeding.
You are too familiar, and I can't have it.
Considering the shortness of the time we have known each other, Mr. Smith, you take too much upon you. You think I am a country girl, and it doesn't matter how you behave to me.
I assure you, Miss Swancourt, that I had no idea of freak in my mind. I wanted to imprint a sweet serious kiss upon your hand, and that's all.
Now, that's creeping round again.
And you mustn't look into my eyes so, she said, shaking her head at him, and trotting on a few paces in advance. Thus she led the way out of the lane and across some fields in the direction of the cliffs. At the boundary of the fields nearest the sea she expressed a wish to dismount. The horse was tied to a post, and they both followed an irregular path, which ultimately terminated upon a flat ledge passing round the face of the huge blue-black rock at a height about midway between the sea and the topmost verge.
There, far beneath and before them, lay the everlasting stretch of ocean.
There, upon detached rocks, were the white screaming gulls, seeming ever intending to settle, and yet always passing on.
Right and left ranked the toothed and zigzag line of storm-torn heights, forming the series which culminated in the one beneath their feet.
Behind the youth and maiden was a tempting alcove and seat, formed naturally in the beetling mass, and wide enough to admit two or three persons. Elfride sat down, and Stephen sat beside her.
"I am afraid it is hardly proper of us to be here, either," she said half-inquiringly. "We have not known each other long enough for this kind of thing, have we?"
"Oh yes," he replied judicially, "quite long enough."
"How do you know?"
"It is not length of time, but the manner in which our minutes beat, that makes enough or not enough in our acquaintanceship."
"Yes, I see that. But I wish Papa suspected or knew what a very new thing I am doing. He does not think of it at all."
"Darling Elfie, I wish we could be married. It is wrong for me to say it, I know it is before you no more, but I wish we might be, all the same. Do you love me deeply, deeply?"
"No," she said in a fluster. At this point-blank denial, Stephen turned his face away decisively, and preserved an ominous silence, the only objects of interest on earth for him being apparently the 3 or 4 score seabirds circling in the air afar off.
"I didn't mean to stop you quite," she faltered with some alarm, and seeing that he still remained silent, she added more anxiously, "If you say that again, perhaps, I will not be quite so obstinate if you don't like me to be."
"Oh, my Elfride!" he exclaimed, and kissed her. It was Elfride's first kiss. And so awkward and unused was she, full of striving no relenting. There was none of those apparent struggles to get out of the trap which only results in getting further in, no final attitude of receptivity, no easy close of shoulder to shoulder, hand upon hand, face upon face, and, in spite of coyness, the lips in the right place at the supreme moment. That graceful though apparently accidental falling into position, which many have noticed as precipitating the end and making sweethearts the sweeter, was not here.
Why? Because experience was absent. A woman must have had many kisses before she kisses well. In fact, the art of tendering the lips for these amatory salutes follows the principles laid down in treatises on legerdemain for performing the trick called forcing a card. The card is to be shifted nimbly, withdrawn, edged under, and withal not to be offered till the moment the unsuspecting person's hand reaches the pack, this forcing to be done so modestly and yet so coaxingly, that the person trifled with imagines he is really choosing what is in fact thrust into his hand. Well, there were no such facilities now, and Stephen was conscious of it first with a momentary regret that his kiss should be spoiled by her confused receipt of it, and then with the pleasant perception that her awkwardness was her charm.
"And you do care for me and love me?" said he.
"Yes."
"Very much?"
"Yes."
"And I mustn't ask you if you'll wait for me, and be my wife someday?"
"Why not?" she said naively. "There is a reason why, my Elfride."
"Not anyone that I know of."
"Suppose there is something connected with me which makes it almost impossible for you to agree to be my wife, or for your father to countenance such an idea?"
"Nothing shall make me cease to love you, no blemish can be found upon your personal nature. That is pure and generous, I know, and having that, how can I be cold to you? And shall nothing else affect us, shall nothing beyond my nature be a part of my quality in your eyes, Elfie?"
"Nothing whatever," she said with a breath of relief.
"Is that all? Some outside circumstance? What do I care?"
"You can hardly judge, dear, till you know what has to be judged. For that, we will stop till we get home. I believe in you, but I cannot feel bright.
Love is new, and fresh to us as the dew, and we are together. As the lover's world goes, this is a great deal. Stephen, I fancy I see the difference between me and you, between men and women generally, perhaps. I am content to build happiness on any accidental basis that may lie near at hand. You are for making a world to suit your happiness."
"Elfride, you sometimes say things which make you seem suddenly to become 5 years older than you are, or than I am, and that remark is one. I couldn't think so old as that, try how I might, and no lover has ever kissed you before?"
"Never."
"I knew that, you were so unused. You ride well, but you don't kiss nicely at all, and I was told once, by my friend Knight, that is an excellent fault in woman. Now, come, I must mount again, or we shall not be home by dinner time." And they returned to where Pansy stood tethered. "Instead of entrusting my weight to a young man's unstable palm," she continued gaily, "I prefer sure rubbing stock, as the villagers call it, in the form of a gate. There now I am myself again." They proceeded homeward at the same walking pace. Her blitheness won Stephen out of his thoughts.